Okay, as we have already mentioned a number of times in our study of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, there are several central themes of his writings that are revisited in all three epistles. The two primary ones that I want to emphasize here, number one is love, and specifically love for brethren, which is indicated in the behavior toward them. And then secondly, obedience to truth. Fidelity to truth, faithfulness to the truth of God as well. So those are the two things that are going to be emphasized in this epistle as well. And the best way perhaps to look at it as we consider the text of 3 John is that there are three individuals that John describes in this epistle. The first one is the one to whom it is written, which is Gaius. The second one, Diotrephes. And then there is a verse 12, a reference to a man by the name of Demetrius, who, when you look at the context, may very well be one of the ones that Diotrephes had a problem with. And so these three individuals have certain characteristics that are present, that are borne out by their actions. And by the way, that's always what is significant. There are people who will claim to be a particular type of person, whereas in their actions, the way they conduct themselves, they show themselves to be something entirely different. Our actions bear out the type of individuals that we are. A good tree does not bear bad fruit. And I think that that's kind of interesting, especially when you see, for example, people who are famous in our society, sports figures or movie star or something like that, who are caught in some criminal act or some evil that they wanted to keep hidden, and they'll consistently say, "That's not who I am." They'll make an apology after they're caught about those things. That's not me. That's not the type of person that I am. And then they'll claim to be someone far different, someone who has uttered racial epithets. We'll say, "I'm not a racist." Individuals who are caught in immorality or promiscuity will say, "I'm not immoral." It's a difficult sell to say that an individual is not a particular way when that's the way they act. And again, the principles of Scripture establish that a good tree, again, does not bear bad fruit, or a bad tree, good fruit. And so it's important that our actions be consistent with our character, and that our character be a righteous character. And that's not to say that we're going to be perfect in that regard, but the manner of life, the conversation of life, that is characteristic of a particular person, bears out the type of person he is. And so there is a reason why he calls us to godliness, and a reason why Gaius can be described as an individual who is loving and hospitable, because in verses 5 through 8, those are the things that he is commended for. That is, his actions indicate something of his character. And so if you'll notice, again, reading verses 5 and 8, he says to Gaius, "Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have been borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well, because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such, that we may become fellow workers for the truth." Now, we identify the type of individual that Gaius was by looking at what he was doing, his hospitality and his support for those who proclaimed the gospel. We emphasized last week that the phrase, "and for strangers" in verse 5, looking at the specific context here, does not have reference to just strangers in general, but individuals of which he did not have personal knowledge, who came in bringing and preaching the truth of the gospel. He housed those individuals despite the fact that he didn't know them personally. He helped them and supported them in the preaching of the gospel. So this is something that showed hospitality to those who are proclaiming the truth of God, but also it's an indication that he actually supported them in the work that he did. We talked about the fact that we don't know for certain what means Gaius had, but there is that reference in the prayer that was offered in previous verses, that you may prosper, verse 2, in all things and be in health just as your soul prospers. indicating that it was obvious that Gaius, his soul was prospering. He was a righteous individual doing God's will. It was Paul's desire that he would prosper in all things, having reference to material things and his health and such like, so that the work of the gospel that he was engaging in could go forward. So he was very hospitable, again, an individual who was active in the supporting of the gospel. The only other thing that we emphasized in our comments last week was the contrast between the commendation of Gaius for supporting the preaching of the gospel related to these verses, as contrasted with the condemnation of those who would support men in preaching error that was found in the previous epistle in 2 John verses 9 through 11. We are called not to receive into our house, greet, or support individuals who do not proclaim the doctrine of Christ. And we're told that if we do that, that there is an endorsement that comes with it, that we are participating or sharing in their evil deeds, whereas Gaius here is commended for the fact that he did support and accept and receive into his house individuals who are preaching the truth. And you'll notice there again in verse 8, as such, he said, we also receive such, these individuals, that we may become fellow workers for the truth. And that fellow workers, that's again an indication of participation or fellowship. So it's important that we be discerning with regard to the efforts that we make in supporting and helping preaching that is done. And the key, as indicated in the contrast between 2 John and 3 John, as to whether one is worthy of such fellowship and such support, is whether or not they are abiding in the doctrine of Christ, or as indicated in 3 John, if they are indeed preaching the truth. And Gaius did that, and he was commended for it. So, concerning the verses 5 through 8, as well as the information that we have presented with regard to Gaius and his work, does anyone have any comments or questions that they want to add to what we've discussed before we get into a discussion of diatrophies? Good. That must mean I got through it all. Well, let's go to verse 9 then. And here we find the central conflict of the book, the epistle. And I think that most probably the reason for John's writing, it is, again, a private personal letter that he wrote to Gaius. You'll notice in verse 9, the statement, I wrote to the church by Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among us, does not receive us, that that John is expressing some frustration with the fact that the letter that he wrote to the church was not having the effect that he desired because of Diotrephes' presence. This was a separate letter that was written to Gaius to encourage him in the face of this opposition that is being expressed. Now, it was mentioned, and again, it's something that perhaps is intimated, something that we can maybe not dogmatically, but we can assume is the case, is that Gaius perhaps was on the outs at this particular time as a result of his support of men that Diotrephes would not receive. You'll notice as you get the explanation of his evil in verses 9 and following, he says he does not receive us. Verse 10, therefore if I come, I'll call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words, and not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren, and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. And again, when you couple that together with what Gaius was doing, then it very well may be that Diotrephes was successful in expelling Gaius as a result of what Gaius was doing and faithfully supporting individuals who were coming in holding to truth. That's something that's not explicitly stated, but it certainly is a case to where you have a conflict that exists between Diotrephes and Gaius because of Gaius' persistence in doing right and Diotrephes' unwillingness to do what was right. Now, concerning that, you'll notice in verse 11, he said, beloved. Now, he's writing again to Gaius. He says, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. He who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God. And then he refers to Petrus, who has a good testimony from all and from the truth itself, and we also bear witness, and you know that our testimony is true. So verses 9 through 12, again, deal with the specific conflict, consist of a condemnation of Diotrephes, an exhortation of Gaius to remain faithful in what it was that he did, perhaps an endorsement of an individual, Demetrius, who may very well have been among those who was not received by Diotrephes because of his envy and because of his pride. So let's talk first about Diotrephes. Diotrephes, growing up throughout the years that I've read and studied this and heard individuals preach and teach on it, there's a term that is used concerning Diotrephes that I think is pretty applicable. That Diotrephes was a church boss. And I want to describe what I mean by that, because there's nothing necessarily wrong with being a boss. But when we look at Scripture, what we find is that there are instructions given concerning the oversight of any particular congregation. Now, there's nothing indicated in the text concerning elders as to whether elders were present, whether Diotrephes himself may have been serving as an elder or not. But what you find in New Testament Scriptures concerning oversight in a congregation is that men who are qualified to serve in the capacity of elder make up an eldership. When you look at the New Testament pattern, you will find that without exception, that there was always a plurality of men serving as elders in any particular local congregation. Instructions that were given both to Titus, as well as explanations given concerning what the Apostle Paul did in his missionary work, is that elders were appointed. Elders, plural, were appointed. Every example that you find of a reference that is given in the New Testament is to a multiplicity or plurality of men serving in that particular place. Now, that's not the denominational construct. We have in the religious world today the pastor, and of course, as the denominations look at our congregation as an example, since I'm the one that's up here teaching the class and will preach a bit later, they will say, well, there is the pastor, not realizing there are a couple of things wrong with that. Number one, I am not a pastor in the sense that I have not been appointed to serve in that capacity. These are older men who have these various qualifications given in Timothy and Titus. And number two, that there is not one pastor that is over a church regarding the pattern that is found in the New Testament. It's always a plurality of men serving as elders. So we have what we might refer to as an eldership that exists in any particular law congregation that has such men. Now, that's not to say that every congregation has elders, because think it's a very logical thing. Number one, you have to have certain qualifications to serve. If you have a congregation that exists and there are men in that congregation, they don't have that qualification. There are not two or more men who have the qualification to serve as elders, then you'll have a congregation that will not have an eldership. It's hard to prove a negative, but just make note of the fact, and maybe an indication as to why there's so many problems in Corinth. But when you look at the letters that are written by the Apostle Paul to the Church of Corinth, there's not an indication that elders exist in that congregation. It seems to me, again, not trying to prove a negative by silence, but perhaps some problems may have been avoided. Perhaps some specific admonitions to the elders would have been given if the problems existed in Corinth, should they have actually existed. So Corinth may be an example of a congregation that existed without elders, perhaps no men qualified. But the very fact that you have congregations in various places and Titus being given instructions to go and appoint men as elders indicates that before the appointment that they didn't have that. So again, I don't know what the situation is here. But there are, as a result of this God-designed and ordained plan concerning having a plurality of men with qualifications that basically consist of a righteous demeanor and a proven ability to lead righteously that is found within those qualifications, it precludes a single individual being dictatorial in his rule or reign over a congregation of God's people, which is exactly what you find with doctrines. And so the point that I want to make here is if you have strong men who are serving as elders, who are qualified to serve and doing the work as God would have them to do it, then this kind of situation or circumstance should not arise. But these kinds of individuals have to be dealt with. Those who are divisive need to be warned and then dismissed after the first or second warning if they persist in the sinful activities. Because as we look at what Diotrephes was doing, it was very destructive to the church and to the work that God would have done of preaching the gospel. So Diotrephes could be described as a church boss, someone who is dictatorial and determining, making decisions with regard to, specifically, as indicated in this text, with regard to fellowship, who is going to be received, who is not going to be received. And that decision that was made was not based upon who is worthy of Christian fellowship. It was instead based upon his whims. Well, notice his Diotrephes way of establishing it or determining who it is that would be received is based upon his desire to have preeminence and as a result of that, not receiving the brethren, forbidding those who put them out of the church. And so here is an individual who was malicious, an individual who was prating, that is, the malicious words that he proclaimed. Number one, they were lies, but number two, they were designed to destroy. In other words, his purpose was to ruin reputations, and it was motivated by pride. It was his desire to ruin things. Now, it's an unfortunate thing, but it is fairly common for individuals to exist in various congregations who love to have the preeminence because of pride, because of the desire to run things. And by the way, they're not always men. But this specific instance is an example of an individual I've known of, or many anecdotal examples of, for example, elders' wives who were problematic as a result of their desire to have their way and willful with regard to things and cause problems in churches as well. None of that is ever right. It is, of course, it's carnal. It's carnal-minded. Here is an individual who is concerned about self, desiring to exalt self and be in control. And the amazing thing to me about this is that here was the Apostle John that was wanting to come to, and Diotrephes wouldn't have anything to do with him and forbade others to have anything to do with the Apostle John because of his desire for preeminence. Two things that I want to discuss, if y'all have any questions or comments with regarding this. Number one is his nature as a specific person, possibly ways that such things may show themselves among us today so that we can be aware of them and avoid them and to deal with individuals who are this way. And then secondly, just ask this question, and I would like some input as to how could it be that a single individual could be so in control of this fellowship here to where he could accomplish what it was that he was accomplishing and what might could be done to deal with that particular instance. So those are a couple of things that I want to bring out and perhaps discuss as a part of this aspect of our study. Anybody want to start? Okay, those are leading questions, so somebody needs to.
Well, I'm going to start with something else first.
Okay.
It went just similar.
Sure.
But, when he's writing to Gaius, Gaius already knew all these things he's writing, don't you think? I mean, Gaius was doing the right thing, and Paul tells him he did, but Gaius knew he was doing the right thing because he was doing it. And Gaius had to also know about Diotrephes, too, but yet John packages up all this information and encourages Gaius to keep on doing the right thing, because you can't get discouraged when you get... Even if you think you're right, after a while, he can get knocked down. But also, he's very clear about what Diotrephes is doing. And it's not because the guy's grumpy or doesn't have the right kind of personality or something. He's got specific charges that he makes against him. You can just not like somebody sometimes, and it's not... You need to know why, you know, really. You need to know exactly what the evidence is, and John provides it for him. And I just think that's interesting, the way he's sort of taking this lawyer kind of approach to it.
And of course, that's something that's also indicative with regard to the wisdom of the Holy Spirit and the general and broad appeal of the epistles.
Yeah, it's here for us, not just Gaius, not just the letter to Gaius.
Because now that he related these things to Gaius, we know what a church boss is too, and how he works and why he works, and can identify those things ourselves so that we might avoid them or deal with them or maintain our steadfastness in doing right in the face of those things, as he's exhorting Gaius to do. Yes?
I had him, boss, and he was, well, basically the equal of the
doctrines. Yeah.
Thank you. He was dripping in arrogance, selfishness, and it came very simply put, so everyone can understand. I was to clock in by 6 a.m. at my job. I clock in at 5:57. After hearing the boss yell at me and in front of everyone to belittle me, I am late. And then I showed him my time card, and he simply took it from my hand, threw it on the floor, and walked out. And I turned to him and said, "Are you going to pick up my time card?" And he just kept on going. So he is, I'd say, void of using logic and sincerity, and as much like the personalities I see here, and logic and personality, excuse me, logic and if you know the good character are not in this man, and it does not matter. That's how he's able to control the situation, because he's not being true or logical.
Yeah, and I think that that probably we could go across the room and find quite a few examples of individuals who have had to deal with employers or supervisors or individuals who are this way. And again, when you have those kinds of situations, it's obviously something that is destructive to a business. It is bad for morale. It can be problematic. But when it comes to the church and these kinds of things are happening, when you're dealing with the souls of men and this precious bond of unity that we have as brethren, it is absolutely a horrific circumstance. And we need to be careful that, one, we're not guilty of it, but that we, again, excise that from our fellowship, because it is instructive if we do not.
You were asking how someone like Diotrephes could rise to that level of power. And there are really only two ways that people come to power. One's through leadership. I don't think that's it. And the other is through fear and intimidation. And people like that either frighten people or they're just so obnoxious and uncomfortable that you just don't want to deal with it. Just let them do so I don't have to hear them or put up with them. And it's a really dangerous attitude that we get, but it's a very human one to say, I just don't want to hear it. I just don't. So I'll let him do whatever he wants to do just so I don't have to.
And that's what I did want to bring out, because I do not want to be overly critical of these individuals. And even in Gaius's case, where the person is obviously being commended by John and was doing good work despite he was standing up against Diotrephes, but he still, it wasn't a situation where Diotrephes had been knocked out off of his perch and was no longer a part of that fellowship. And so I don't want to be overly critical of a situation or circumstance like that. But regardless, for us to recognize that the only way an individual can assume this position is if he is allowed to do so, is what I think is one of the most important lessons that we can draw from this. Not everyone is, I suppose, capable of standing up to this kind of thing. Maybe not have the talent or the position or the influence to do so. But you know, if every congregation was to stand for what is right and say no to these kinds of things, nip them in the bud, perhaps. It's a lot easier to nip it in the bud than to deal with it after it's full blown, that's for sure. But then these types of things can be avoided. And it seems like what the Apostle Paul is saying is, I'm going to come help you. I mean, there are two references to the fact that he was coming. You'll notice in verse 10, and of course, it's not a certainty, but it is an indication of his desire to. He said, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds, which he does. I'm going to deal with it. And then later in verse 13, he said, I have many things to write. I do not wish to write to you with pen and ink, but I hope to see you shortly. So it was his desire to come wherever it was that Gaius was and deal with Diotrephes personally. And I have no doubt that John would be able to do that. But again, the vacuum of leadership, the willingness of individuals just to maintain the peace, weariness with regard to putting up with and having to deal with an individual if he doesn't get his way, all of these things can lead to someone like this gaining a position of authority and running a church. But those are not sufficient excuses or reasons to allow that to be. John certainly intended to put an end to it. But he told Gaius to remain righteous without that.
He probably had the money to. He probably financed all of it going on in the church, so they put him so he could gain that position.
You know, that's a very real possibility. James deals with that concerning the favoritism that he decried in the church to which he was writing. He said, you know, you're basically giving the rich these places of honor among you and dismissing the poor man, and it's the rich ones that are mistreating you. Why are you doing this? And indicated that any kind of such favoritism shown to the rich is inappropriate. But having said that, it existed. And it very well may be that that's one of the things. You even see that, again, if you were to go through, you can look at many churches today, churches of Christ, look at the eldership. Who is it that serves as elders in a particular congregation? And often it has more to do with affluence and business acumen and personality than it does whether or not they hold the qualifications that are mentioned in the text. Well, let me say affluence, business acumen, personality, and education. Those are the four things that so many churches look to with regard to who's going to serve as an elder. And you have men who would be qualified to serve that may not have a college degree, may not be wealthy, may be quiet individual, and they're not considered, not because they don't have every single qualification, but simply because they do not have that prestige in the minds of men. You contrast that with individuals who do have that prestige, who may be appointed to serve, even if they don't have the qualifications and will not do a good job. And that's always, whenever carnality is the consideration, as Bruce has indicated, you're looking at it with carnal eyes, fleshly eyes, the eyes of men rather than the eyes of God. That's when you get into trouble with regard to leadership. Right?
I'd like to point out we need to get more than one issue from this. It's not always looking at the other fellows, looking at ourselves. Because we can ask ourselves, have I behaved that way or have I done it in the past? And we can preclude a lot of these problems by simply looking at ourselves.
Very good. And that's of course, what he's telling you in verse 11. He said, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. I think the two big questions that we can ask ourselves by way of application as we look at this particular problem is, number one, am I guilty of being a church boss? And am I aiding or abetting an individual to engage in those activities, either by doing nothing or by actively supporting an individual? I mean, Diotrephes had his supporters, no doubt. And it may be, again, through apathy or through individuals who caused the cult of personality. I mean, we saw that in 1 Corinthians 1. I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, I am of Christ. You have someone who is a strong leader, however he gets there. Dictatorial, immoral, ungodly, there are going to be individuals who will flock to him because of the strength of his personality. So It's a very real danger. Diotrephes isn't the only Diotrephes. He's just the one that's mentioned in this letter. They exist in many places in many congregations.
I was going to say, if they had elders there, did St. John would have written to the elders instead of to Gaius?
Well, that's why I say I don't know. There's nothing indicated about elders. Yeah, he did write to the church, as mentioned in verse 9.
But I would think if the elders were so weak to let something like that happen, that they would be criticized for it.
So,
should have been written to them for not taking care of the situation.
You know, having seen instances of this kind of behavior and this type of person in my lifetime, again, as an anecdote and just an example that I had in my personal experience, most often these kinds of individuals exist where that vacuum is present, where there are no elders, certainly. But there are times, and I think of one in particular, where one of the elders was this type of individual. And he was, in every sense of the term, the head elder, even though that's not a scriptural concept. It certainly was one that was present. And the others basically just rubber stamped whatever it was that he wanted to do. And it was not a good situation either. Anytime there's a church boss, an individual, again, two things. He's making the decisions individually. He's doing it because of pride and a desire for preeminence. You got a problem every time. Ron, back to you.
A little anecdotal story in here. The congregation that appointed an elder was not qualified, and it pointed out, and they said, well, he'll grow into it. Well, no, he won't grow into it. The congregation will end up having problems because it was self-administered. That's something I think is done more often than we really realize.
That's a good point. Good point. Yes.
These short 14 verses, there's a lot going on behind these 14 verses that you just don't know.
Right.
And I can almost read between some of the lines, but not quite. But it reminds me of one of my favorite movies called High Noon, Gary Cooper. This Diotrephes is holding this church hostage. We don't know exactly why. We've heard some suggestions. Maybe it's his house, and there's nowhere else to bring it. I think there's nowhere else to go. But he's holding the church hostage. Gaius, don't know if he's a member there, if he was put out. It looks like he may have been. He knows which church John's talking about because he doesn't identify the church. We don't know if he just helped the brethren to get to that town. But it appears that the reason for the letter is verse 11. That's why he wrote it. Now, Gaius is a great man. He loves the brethren. He's doing right by them. But Demetrius, if he's the one who took the letter to the church, Gaius housed him, was hospitable to him. And he learned something from Gaius and took it back to John. John wrote the letter as a result of what he learned from Demetrius or whoever the brethren were that went and had to come back. And the reason he wrote it was because he had to tell Gaius, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. So he got from them that Gaius, his emotional state, I don't know what it is, but he's about to go up against, as Gary Cooper, he's about to go up against the bad guy. And he's saying no. If he was put out, he's really got no business going back and trying to do anything like that. He says, you leave it to me, and I'll take care of it. What I would love to have seen is what happened when John got there.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
Because this is a serious problem. You look at Sardis in Revelation 3. But the whole church was caught up in the error there, except for two or three. And I've always assumed that they were members of the church there also, but all Jesus says in the letter was that in Sardis, they're there in the city, but we don't even know if they're in the congregation still. So it may be that they have been put out.
Yeah, there's a difference between probability and possibility and certainty in regard to all those things. And that is a very good point to make, that John here is not admonishing Gaius to do something about Diotrephes.
Right.
It's an interesting point that you make, and that is, it's a letter of encouragement to Gaius to keep on doing what you're doing, and not to be like him, not to be like him. And it very well may be. And this is certainly an important admonition to be given. It's something that I've written about a number of times in the conflicts that I've been involved with from time to time, dealing with error and such. Is I've seen men who are dealing with error, who themselves are acting in ungodly ways. It may be that they're being prideful. It may be that they're being arrogant. It may be that they are taking a tack that is, in some way carnal or inappropriate, and feel justified in doing that because they're fighting bad guys. And that doesn't give justification. The end doesn't justify the means. So there is the need for that admonition for an individual to act in a godly way despite how others may treat you or what the circumstances might be. So it's very difficult to be righteous in the midst of conflict. That's not an easy thing to do. And it's important that's the most important thing that we can do, so that there is no cause for criticism. Because if individuals have a right to criticize us for our actions, for our demeanor, for our motivation in regard to those things, then the truth suffers as a consequence of it. Secondly, and this is something you pointed out, he wasn't part of it. Whether he was at one time, whether he'd been, he wasn't there. He's an outsider now, for whatever reason it was, and that's something that is obvious. So your point about not telling him to go back is a legitimate one. I'd say three or four times where I have been asked questions by individuals who have left a congregation. Instances that I'm thinking of specifically, they left the congregation because they no longer wanted to be a part of what they considered to be unscriptural and godly practices, and I was in agreement with them that those things were wrong. What they wanted to do as they left was to shoot off a letter, a scorched earth letter, to everybody in the congregation, bypassing the elders of that congregation and such, and basically being critical of the congregation and as such get in the last word. And I told them don't do it. I thought it was a bad idea. Number one, it's not doing good. It's just going to satisfy an urge that you have to exonerate yourself. Number two, you're going to be criticized, and hard feelings are going to result because there's a reason why you're leaving and they're staying. Maybe they don't agree with you, or their perception of things are different. And most commonly, when they have brought the letter to me, it's said two or three times, and I've read the letter, they've exhibited an ungodly attitude and spirit and tone and all that in the letter itself. That is completely inappropriate for someone who calls themselves a Christian. What happens in those kinds of situations, whenever conflict exists, especially if it's spiritual conflict, especially if you are convinced that you have the truth and that these things are things that that have potentially eternal consequences, you become so emotional, so caught up in the personality and the person and all of those kinds of things that it leads you to say rash things, engage in ungodly actions, use wrong words, bad tone, those kinds of things. And brethren, it's destructive, it does absolutely no good, and it is not defensible. And it's something we need to try to avoid. And I'm not saying that sin should be dealt with. Again, it was John's place to do it, and he was going to do it. He was going to deal with Dr. Fitz. But sin has to be dealt with. But what's most important is for us, when we see all of the evil and all the sin and all the error that exists, that we ourselves always conduct ourselves righteously and godly. And that's what he was admonishing Gaius to do in this particular text. Okay, so that's the big lesson, the important lesson that he was trying to teach Gaius, is this is indicated in the one that we need to learn as well. Verse 11, beloved, do not imitate what is evil, what is good. And he gives the reason for that. That is, he who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God. And that's, if you need any reason why you should act right when others aren't, that's the reason. And it's a good one. All right. I got to preach a little bit. I think actually Roger was first in the day.
Okay. Well, there's a kind of a religious viewpoint that prevalent that sort of love covers everything, trumps everything. And nobody says more about love than John, Apostle John does. But yet here he is in verse 10-11 saying, there is such a thing as good, there is such a thing as evil, and here it is in Diotrephes, and I'm going to deal with it. And I think it's a pretty good lesson for folks who just want to spread some love over every kind of issue and avoid it.
Especially in the church.
Yeah, because
especially, this evil was in the church.
Especially in the church. And love is not ignoring the things that are wrong. And John's pretty specific about dealing with this. So I think you can kind of take away some ammunition from folks who just want to kind of cover it up with love.
Well, as we know, the officers were the child of God, and property was very knowledgeable in the scriptures, and as you brought out that, and he had support, not those he just put up with, but the supporters of his property, I've seen that, or they wouldn't stand up to him, as you brought out, they intimidate people and that, and they said they put him out of the church. Well, how can you do that? So I'm thinking about a congregation in Irving, I guess they sold bonds to build the building, and the guy about to, he purchased most of the bonds, and so he was the church boss, and everybody wasn't saying anything, but turn the church, well, how many bonds do you have, And how we put on the church, he changed the locks on the church building,
And legally, perhaps, because...
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's a good example. Like I said, they Diotrephes exist in a lot of different places.
Kind of going, rather piggybacking off of what you had said about people not confronting this initially, nipping it in the bud, and kind of along the I believe it was High Noon that Dennis was talking about, and what Roger was talking about, people sometimes, I've seen it myself, don't confront things thinking that they're going to be holding the peace, but they're in no way holding the peace, because there is no peace between the individuals, at least at very base, doctrinally. There is no harmony and there is no concord. I mean, it's like when you say you're going to hold the peace by not doing anything about it, how much peace is there if I stick you in a closet with a rattlesnake? You guys might not be attacking each other, but there's not going to be any peace in that closet. No rest.
That image that we see is the ostrich with his head in the sand, and you hear phrases like kicking it under the rug and those kinds of things, and what it is out of sight. It doesn't mean it's out of mind. It doesn't mean that it's not going to reach out and get you, because it eventually will. And that's why, you'll remember last week, we talked at least quickly about the situation in Acts 6 in Jerusalem with regard to the Grecian widows. The apostles dealt with problems so they get back to work. And those kinds of things do need to be dealt with. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention. We're out of time. I want to pick up with the commendation to Demetrius in verse 12. Talk about that a little bit. Final words of farewell, and then we'll get into the discussion question, which means we should be able to finish our material on 3 John next week. And then we'll hand out the outlines for Jude at that time. But if you would like one before, remember they're on the back table. Thank you very much for your kind attention today.